A collection of everything. So big it can never be catalogued or appraised. The loot of the world.
You got 5 seconds to tell me where you buried the loot. Where's the loot?
I don't know who's got the loot. I don't know if anybody's got the loot.
Hello, looters. Welcome to Thief's Monthly Movie Loot, our first episode of year two. I hope that everybody's doing well. We have a lot of great new things in store for this episode and this year, so we're glad you're listening. As opposed to previous episodes where the loot is whatever films I've seen during the past weeks, this year we're going to take a certain topic and discuss it with a guest. For our first loot of the year, we're going to talk about directorial debuts. And for this first episode, we have a great friend, Leonard Rubart. So let's begin.
The first loot.
Hello, Leonard. Welcome to Thief's Monthly Movie Loot. How are you doing?
I'm doing fine. How are you?
Fine. And we're doing great. Why don't you tell everybody a bit about yourself?
Okay. I'm Leonard. I'm 20 years old. I live in Belgium. I'm probably too obsessed with movies than what most people would consider healthy. I also host a podcast called the Talking Pictures Podcast with my friend Jake Lundberg. I'm still new at this, so I apologize for if it's a little bit rough.
No, that's okay. That's okay. Like I said, he's from Belgium. He's a fellow film lover. He's also an artist and one of my favorite persons on the internet. So I'm glad to have you here, Leonard.
I'm very glad to finally speak to you face-to-face as much as screen-to-screen, rather, but...
Yeah, like I said, this is a day of first, because the theme we're gonna deal with has to do with first, and this is actually the first time that we talk outside of Twitter and the internet, so that's great.
Yeah.
I'm gonna be honest with everybody, if you're gonna indulge me here a bit. Leonard wasn't supposed to be here today. I had another guest in mind, another great Twitter friend. We had everything set for a while, but unfortunately, due to some personal issues, she couldn't make it. That's why the episode is coming out a bit later than I had planned. But anyway, when I realized I had to look for an alternate guest, I had a couple of names in mind, but most of them didn't really work for what I had in mind for this episode. You see, since this is the first episode of the year and the first episode with this new format I'm trying, I wanted someone that was in some way representative of my journey as a cinephile. The guest that was originally supposed to be here was that, which made it harder to look for someone else that fit that criteria. But although Leonard was one of the names I had in mind from the beginning, the more I thought of him, the more it made sense for what I wanted. You see, I've known Leonard for what? For how long have we known each other?
I joined the Corriorino firm in 2017, so about, like, I was 16, so about nearly 4 years.
Okay, you weren't in Rotten Tomatoes, right?
No, I was never in Rotten Tomatoes.
Okay. So around three or four years, roughly. Mm. So anyway, Leonard and I have been interacting with each other for 3 or so years in various film forums. And film forums have been an integral part of my journey as a cinephile ever since I set foot in the Entertainment Weekly forums back in the late 90s. But years after I landed at Rotten Tomatoes and then Corriorino, where I met Leonard, so you, sir, are not only part of my growth as a film fan and as a cinephile, but also in many ways you are an inspiration. So I wanted to tell you that right away.
It's too much honor.
No, I like you said, you are way into films for someone so young, which is an inspiration and is something that, yeah, if I had gotten into films as much as you do when I was 16, you know, I don't know what would have happened. But I'm pleased to have you here, and I hope to have a good conversation.
I think you're better off this way. I'm just...
So
it all turned out fine.
Yeah. So we are now sharing in a new film forum called movieforums.com. So shout out to our MOFA friends that might listen to this. So one of the other things that I wanted to tell you, like I said, if I'm going to be honest with you, even though I had your name on my short list from the beginning, I kept going past it because I felt a bit intimidated. Because like I say, you are way younger than I am and way more into art house cinema and foreign films than I am. So I kept thinking, will it work? Will, won't it work? I don't know, but I'm confident that the recording is going to turn out well.
I'm not that into art house cinema as some might think. That's actually a recent development in my taste, mostly by happenstance. So I don't think you should be intimidated at all. Like, I don't think I will be able to keep up with you actually today.
I think you can. No, but that's okay. So to talk a bit about yourself first, how did you get into films?
Okay, so I wasn't like someone who, like every kid watches movies, but I wasn't really obsessed with them as I know some people on the internet were. Like, I was into books, really. And then I lost interest in books, and then movies took that place. Around like when I was 14, I watched Fantastic Mr. Fox by Wes Anderson. And I was a really big fan of the writer Roald Dahl, who wrote the original novel.
Yeah.
And something clicked in me, because up to that point, I didn't really realize what movies could do, but Wes Anderson has such a specific style that I realized, it's not just actors show up on a set and a scene is filmed. It's actually, there's a language involved. And that made me just like, oh, okay, this is a new thing I need to explore. And got really serious around 15 or 16 years old. Also, at a certain point, I discovered that not very far from my house, there was a repertory theater, which played a lot of old movies for very cheap prices. So that was somewhat my film school.
Wes Anderson is a filmmaker I've struggled a bit with. I haven't seen a lot of his films, mm-hmm. but he really doesn't click with me. I don't know. But I haven't ventured more into his filmography.
I understand when you say like, I'm not really into him because he does a very specific thing.
Yeah, I should give it a try. Maybe rewatch the first ones because I really don't remember much about them. So maybe I should give him a shot. So like Leonard said, and sticking with the theme of debuts and first, Leonard just started his own podcast this January along with his friend Jake. And it's called Talking Pictures. Why don't you tell us about it and how did it came to be?
Like, I started talking to Jake back in June this year. That's when we started talking on a daily basis. Up till then, we just, like, as you normally do, you talk on Twitter, like, you comment on each other's posts. And then, at a certain point, we just started chatting every day. Like, he would send me morning when it was 2 p.m. in my time. And then I always wanted to start a podcast, but I didn't want to do it because I was, first of all, too young. And with doing a podcast, you kind of present yourself as someone with a certain sense of expertise, even if you don't mean that, but you kind of, it's kind of if your thoughts more weight than they probably deserve. When you air them on the internet. And I needed someone who I could talk to, who I would be comfortable with. And I didn't really find that person until I met Jake. And at a certain point, we just got bored enough in quarantine. And we thought, oh, it would be fun if we had like a project that would force us to talk every once in a while, like not just through chat, but face-to-face or screen-to-screen. And now we're shaming everyone in listening to it.
I was listening. You're two episodes in, right?
Yeah, but we have the third and the fourth are recorded.
Okay. I was listening to the second one, and you really got it. You both have a good rapport, and you're doing good, really. It's fun. This is good to listen to you too.
Okay, that's great to hear.
So one of the things that I wanted to do with this new format is to develop a theme for each episode, theme that we could go back and forth. And the theme that I had for this first episode was directorial debuts. Not that Leonard or me are any experts on debuts specifically, but I thought it would be a good theme to bounce around and talk about it. But since it's, like I said, the first episode, first of the year, first episode with a guest, I wanted to do something like that. So what do you say, Leonard? Let's talk about this. When talking about directorial debuts, I was thinking that one can take any directorial debut and classify it within three or four categories, maybe. Mm-hmm. First, there's the young prodigy or film enthusiast that starts to make a film with a small budget, mm-hmm. an independent film or something really small. Then there's the studio hired director that maybe doesn't necessarily have control over what he directs, and he just lands a project and he directs it, and then eventually went on to direct other things. And there are also the rare occasions where you have a studio hired mm-hmm. director that gets all control over his project to make a film. And I was thinking about many examples, and I think we can fit almost every directorial debut in any of those slots. What do you think? Any slot that you think I might be missing, or any other directorial debut classification?
I think the three categories you give are broad enough that you could fit most people in there. I can't come up with a specific contradiction. I think you can still take every slot and then divide them into subcategories.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Is there any debut that, I know we're going to share at the end our top five directorial debuts, but is there anyone that left a mark on you or was particularly impressive, maybe without spoiling too much for the list we're going to reveal later, but anyone you want to talk about in particular?
Yesterday, I decided to watch a movie that was on my list for a very long time. It's called Elevator to the Gallows by Louis Malle.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was quite familiar with Malle's work that he did after that. I have seen about 11 or 12 of his movies, but I hadn't seen this one. And it's kind of impressive to do that when you're just starting out. Louis Malle was Cousteau's cameraman.
I didn't know that.
I think he was his cameraman. It was at least part of his crew. And to do the things that Cousteau did, he needed just people to accomplish it, and that's how Malle got started. And Elevator to the Gallows is an interesting movie if you compare it to what crime movies were in the 1950s in America. And it is kind of like, he was already bebopping it, what the Americans were doing it at the same time, quite literally by adding music score by Miles Davis.
I've only seen one Malle film, or Wallace and Funds. It's the only one I've seen, which is great. It's an excellent film. But I really haven't seen anything else from him. But I've heard great things about that. I've had it on my watch list for maybe too long. But I really haven't ventured into it.
Mm.
I didn't even know it was his first film. I didn't know it was his debut. If we were going to classify it into the three slots I mentioned, in which one would you put it?
It's hard to say if it was a studio production. I didn't really look that up, but like in Europe, the difference between independent and studio is a little bit vaguer, because there isn't really a giant industry. But it did have like some big stars, but I don't know how famous they were at the time. But like Jeanne Moreau is in it, who had her birthday yesterday. To me, she's a famous person, but her most iconic movies would come out later, like Jules et Jim or La Notte, which would come in the early 60s. This is a movie from 1956. I think the biggest name at that time was actor Lino Ventura, who was a giant wrestling legend when he was younger, and then he turned into a famous actor later on. Like, he would work with Melville a lot and making a lot of French crime movies. I didn't even know he was in it. He only shows up halfway through. But I think he's the, like, I don't think he's the biggest name now with what some of the stars went on to do later. But I think at the time he was probably the most well-known of all of them.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that one out, because like I said, I've read great things about it, and for some reason I've never seen it. Any other directorial debut you like to highlight or talk about?
I think an interesting one to point out is Ridley Scott's first movie was The Duelist. I saw it somewhere in 2019 on the big screen, and it was a very fun time, but he was already 40 or 41 when he made that, because he was a famous commercial director. Like, he would do advertisements, those kind of stuff. You know, he was already had an accomplished career before he went on to make movies, so his first movie so self-assured and so polished. It's like almost impossible to compare to most debut films out there. That also explains why he could reinvent the sci-fi genre twice with his second and third movie.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one either, but I've read a bit about it. And actually, I think I read something to that idea. The film is so good, it's pretty solid. I didn't even know what it was about, but I think I should check it out too. So that's another one for the watch list.
Yeah, it's a very fun movie.
One of the ones I would like to highlight, and I don't even know much about the director, but it's one that left a mark, and I got it out from my top five, is The Wicker Man,
mm-hmm,
from Robin Hardy. I don't know if you've seen it.
No, I have not.
No? Oh, yeah. You have to see that film.
Yeah.
It's a film that, once it started, I saw it about 2 or 3 years ago. 5 minutes after it started, I was wondering, what the heck is this?
Mm-hmm.
Because it's so weird, it's so unique, but once it gets the ball rolling, you're captured into the plot, you're wondering what is going on, and it's so unique in many ways that it really, really leaves a mark. And it's a film that, even after it finished, yes, I was blown away by it, but as time went on, I kept thinking about that film, and it got stuck in my mind, and I kept thinking about it, and I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I said, you know, this film was really good. So I'm not going to say anything else. You probably know a bit about it, but you should check it out. It's really, really good.
Yeah.
The man went on to direct like 2 or 3 more films. He didn't do anything. He actually did like a sequel.
Yeah.
I think it's called The Wicker Tree. Never seen it, but you should really check it out.
He also had like a lot of bad luck with its release, because he made for a certain studio, and then the studio got a new boss, and the new boss wanted to make sure that the project of the old boss failed, so his new projects would look better. So I think he cut the movie, and he kind of buried it, so that director's career got smothered from the early get-go.
Which is another thing that I wanted to talk about. In your opinion, what do you think is the best recipe for a director, for a starting, debuting director? What do you think might lead to a better result? I know that every case is individual, but in your opinion, as a cinephile and a film lover, what do you think is the best route? Is it the studio hire guy? Is it having the big budget, or starting small? Or
I think when you're starting as a studio director, you're usually not, it's not your first time making a movie. You're often, I think, involved in other ways of production before you. There are a lot of writers who will first write a bunch of movies before they start their career as a studio director. I think most people will probably start with doing something small. I think a lot about like something Robert Rodriguez said when he made his first movie, El Mariachi, which I haven't seen, but he said, like, okay, he made a list of everything that he could use in a movie. Like, okay, I have a friend, he has a bar, I can shoot in the bar. Okay, this guy has a guitar, I can use that. And then he wrote the script with the things he already had.
That's a good approach.
I think that's a good way to work.
Yeah, yeah. I asked the question just to bounce it around, but like I said, there's no sure recipe. What worked for someone might not work for another guy. For example, you have someone like Orson Welles, who is a unique case, because he was a radio star that was handed the world. They gave him full control of the project. You know, you can do whatever you want. You have, and he asked for it. He was bold enough to ask for it because he knew the studio wanted him, and he said, you know, I want control from pre to post production. I want final cut rights, and he batted it out of the park because he came with what is considered the best picture in the world. And then you have someone like David Fincher, who I'm not going to equate him completely, but he was a video music star. He was a video music director, and they handed him the keys to a franchise that was extremely popular, the Aliens franchise. They say, you know, here you go. But the difference is that they didn't give him all the control he wanted. So he had very bad luck with that experience, which he has talked about a lot.
Yeah.
To the point that he doesn't even count the film as one of his films. He said, no, I didn't do that. That's not my film. So there are very different situations that can occur with the same background.
James Cameron does the same thing with an early Corman movie he did. I think it was a Piranha sequel.
Piranha 2.
Yeah, he also pretends he didn't do that.
Yeah, but and in that case, if I'm not mistaken, I think he wasn't set to direct, and they fired the director, and then he stepped in. He was the special effects supervisor or something like that, and he stepped in. And I'm sure he doesn't want to talk a lot about that.
No.
So we can continue talking about that, but what do you say you play a game?
Okay.
Okay?
I'm good with that.
So I have a game, and the game is called Is It a Debut?
Mm-hmm.
Just like the title says, I'm going to mention several films,
mm-hmm.
and you have to tell me if they're a debut or not.
Okay.
What do you say?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. Here's the first one. The Maltese Falcon, debut or not?
Yes.
It's a debut, right. Directed by?
John Huston.
John Huston in 1941. He went on to direct such classics as The Treasure of Sierra Madre and The African Queen, and star as one of the most despicable villains in?
Chinatown.
Chinatown, yeah. Great. Have you seen it?
I've seen Chinatown. He did a lot of villains roles later in his career.
Yeah. So let's do another one. The Sixth Sense.
Sixth Sense. No, Shyamalan did another movie before that, or maybe even two.
Yeah, yeah. Shyamalan did two films before Sixth Sense. He directed 1992's Praying with Anger and 1998's Wide Awake. Obviously, Sixth Sense was his breakthrough.
Yeah.
Get Out.
That was his first movie, I think.
Yeah, that's Jordan Peele's first film, for which he received critical acclaim, and he went on to direct Us in 2019.
I always assumed he also directed parts of Key and Peele, but apparently he didn't even do that. So it's really his first movie.
Really? You would think that someone in that comedy environment would direct at least a couple of episodes. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah, I thought so too, but apparently not.
A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
I don't even know that movie.
No?
No.
It's a debut. This was Elia Kazan's first film, released in 1945.
Okay.
It's pretty good.
Okay.
He directed A Streetcar Named Desire and On the Waterfront.
Yeah.
But it's a good film. It's a family film. I mean, not a family film, but it's a film about a family and a girl having to do with his father's alcoholism.
Yeah.
And a couple of other situations in New York. And it's pretty good.
Yeah. Kazan is a great director with a troublesome legacy.
Yeah. Double Indemnity.
Not a first movie.
No.
It's Billy Wilder, and I think he co-directed some French-German movies early on in his career, and then I think his first studio movie was The More the Merrier or something, or Ray Milland comedy.
His first one was, like you said, he was co-directed with Alexander Esway. It was called Mauvais Grain, and The Major and the Minor was his first American film. But yeah, so Double Indemnity is not a debut.
I always mix up The Major and The Minor with The More the Merrier. I don't know why.
It's the M's. It's
this
the
is not
M's.
The first time I've done that.
More the Merrier, yeah. Major, Minor. It's the M's. Heart 8.
Unless you count his 15-minute, his Boogie Nights original concept that's 50 minutes long. But I think Heart 8 is his first feature.
Yeah, it's the first film by Paul Thomas Anderson, released in 1996. And he went on to direct, like you said, Boogie Nights, Magnolia, There Will Be Blood, Phantom Thread, and many, many others.
Yeah. I think he did a 50 minutes, the story of Dick Dickler or something that he used to sell his other two movies on.
That's cool. Duel.
Yes, first movie.
Yeah. Debatable to some, because it was a television film at first, but it was Steven Spielberg's feature film debut. It had a theatrical release in Europe, and it was released in 1971. Pretty good film. I think you liked it a lot, right?
It's my favorite Spielberg movie.
Yeah, I knew it. I remember that you liked it a lot.
Yeah.
It's pretty good, really. Mean Streets.
No, not the first movie.
No. It was it's a very low-budget film, and it's considered one of Scorsese's most personal films, but it was his third film, after Who's That Knocking on My Door and Boxcar Bertha.
Yeah.
The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Didn't he do a movie called Eggheads? Toby Hooper, right?
Yeah,
He did a movie called Eggheads before it.
Eggshells, an independent experimental film. Yeah, that was his first one. Then he went on to Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Memento.
No, Nolan did Following before that.
Yep. That Memento was his second film. He had directed Following in 1998, very low budget and very good thriller. Have you seen it?
I have not seen Following. I'm not a really big Christopher Nolan fan.
But Following is pretty good, really. You should check it out. I'm not a fan of his later work, but...
I know the concept of it and it's very intriguing to me, like this noirish thing that I'm very fond of, so I will watch it eventually.
It's one of those things that I wanted to also brought up. I don't know why, but a lot of these directors, they start small, and once they get famous, they like blow up everything, and they start making movies so big that I think it, in some ways they should probably rein it in and go back to the basics and direct smaller films. I mean, Nolan's like the biggest director probably right now in Hollywood.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen Dunkirk or Tenet. But Interstellar really wasn't very good, at least for me. Maybe I'm going to induce the hatred of film right now, but I really didn't like it. And I think he should really go back to basics and do something small.
Yeah. On one hand, I'm glad that there's one director in the world who's still making big budget movies that are original concepts. But on the other hand, I would like him to see him do something like Memento or something like that. I think he could make it smaller, more concise.
Maybe the same thing maybe I can say to probably David Fincher. I haven't seen Mank, but I've liked all his films. But they're also, I don't know, you get the sense that he's trying to get more recognition and do something more artistic. When I think, you know, maybe he should go back to something like Seven or The Game, even something like that, something more simple.
Yeah, it's really obvious that his last couple of movies, either he's adapting a very popular novel like The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo or Gone Girl, or he's making something that should appeal to Oscars, like The Curious Case of Benjamin Button or The Social Network or Mank. I think Mank is a little bit more of a passion project than anything else he has done. I mean, David Fincher is a fascinating director because, unlike someone like Nolan, who is pretty involved in writing and originating the projects, where Fincher doesn't write and mostly steps in to a project later on, like someone will buy the rights to a novel or Seven, the script was developed, and then he would step in and then he would direct the shit out of it.
Yeah,
I can swear on this, right?
Oh, yeah, whatever. But another thing that weird about Fincher is that even though he works within the studio system, he's very cynical about it, and he's very critical of the system, and I think he has said as much during the last years, but he's still working on it. So let's do two more.
Okay.
Pi
was a debut film by Aronofsky.
Yes, directed by Darren Aronofsky in 1998. It was his first film.
Mm.
Kind of similar to Following. I compare it a lot to Following because they're both films by two directors that eventually became pretty big. But they're small scale, independent, black and white, films about troubled individuals. And it's pretty good. Have you seen it?
No, I haven't.
A last one, Killer's Kiss.
No, that's Kubrick's second movie. He did Fear and Desire before this.
His second film, but it's a very low budget also. It's not as known as his later films, but it's pretty good too.
I own it, but haven't seen it yet. It's an extra on my Blu-ray of The Killing.
It's really good. Obviously, once you set your mind that it's mostly low budget with not very known actors, but it's very good. The only film, the only weak entry for me in Kubrick's filmography is Fear and Desire, and take it as it is. You know, this was a student film pretty much.
I'm not a fan of that either, but there are certain shots in that you're like, oh, I can see that
this guy
is going to become something more later on. Like, it shows promise. Like, not everyone can be man-made Citizen Kane the first time around.
No. Not everybody can be Wells. That's clear.
He also doesn't have the resources of Wells, of course.
Yeah, I think Fear and Desire was also made with some friends and a shoestring budget, and you know, he didn't have, like you say, all the resources. It was independent film. So let's talk about our picks, our debut loot.
Okay.
The ones that you and I consider our favorite directorial debuts. I just finished my list a while ago. I had a couple of titles bouncing around, but I said, okay, what the heck, let's just put them in order. So let's start with you.
Yeah, you already mentioned a couple of mine during your game here. So,
I know, that's okay. Let's start with you. You're number five.
Yeah, my number five was the hardest to pick. I had four that are pretty much set in stone, and then I had like a fifth that could be anything, and then I decided to go with one I just think is very interesting. I also think it's great. It's called Le Silence de la Mer, which is Jean-Pierre Melville's first movie, made in 1949. It's about France in the early years of World War II, so it's occupied France. And a German officer is billeted in the house of this older man and his niece, who's a very young, attractive girl, and they can't refuse him. Like, they're obligated to accept them in their home.
Okay.
But their only real protest that they have left is they refuse to speak to him.
Okay.
So there's this young Nazi officer who is very fond of France. Like, he really wants France and Germany to commerce, like, to get together, because he's very fond of their culture, and he thinks, like, the Germans can elevate themselves by association with the French. And even though they don't talk to him, like, he would come down at night, sit by the fire, and talk to himself, like, monologuing.
Okay.
And it's kind of about thinking about the enemy as not just a symbol.
Okay.
Because it also becomes clear that the Nazi officer has no idea what's actually happening. Like, he has a very idealized idea of what the Nazis' goal is with this. And it's based on a 1942 novella that was a rallying cry for the French resistance during the World War. Like, Melville himself was an active member of the resistance. He was Jewish also. And it's a deceptively simple film that becomes increasingly more nuanced as it goes on. Like, its themes reach further than the limited scope of the setting.
Okay.
And it was also, like, to come back at what you said earlier about the different types of directorial debuts. This movie was made independently, but there wasn't really any independent cinema in late 1940s in France. So this was kind of a big deal, and Melville set up his own studio, like, where he would work, like, almost his entire career. Like, he even used his own studio often as sets.
Okay.
For his own movies. Like, there are certain staircases that will return in a lot of his movies, because he always filmed there. Melville, of course, is most known for his crime movies that inspire Michael Mann later on, with, you know, Le Samurai or Le Cercle Rouge. But early on in his career, like, he was still finding himself, so this was a very personal project for him. And then he would continue to make some other, like, more melodramas or those kind of stuff until, like, in 1955 he would finally settle into the crime genre.
Okay. I hadn't heard of it, so
it's,
I'm gonna keep it in mind.
It's very fascinating.
That's good. So my number five, we've already mentioned it, and I'm gonna start big.
Mm-hmm.
So my number five was Citizen Kane from Orson Welles. You know, taking aside the pedigree that the film has, I rewatched it earlier this month, actually twice. One, the film alone, and then with the Roger Ebert mm-hmm. commentary. I had seen it a long time ago. I have seen it two or three times. But when I rewatched it, you know, it cemented what we already know. The film is great. Not only for mm-hmm. its technical achievements, yeah. which Ebert highlights during his commentary, the way that Welles used light and deep focus, distance, and the way he managed the set and the perspective, the narrative, the flashbacks, and it's everything he did was groundbreaking.
Mm.
And to think that a director mm. could make that on his first film, it's simply impressive. But not only that, the story is yeah. good, the performances are good, the film is great, really. It's yeah. very engaging. I know I saw it a long time ago, and even then I was captivated by it. I wouldn't go as far as to say it's the best film, but I wouldn't complain with anybody that would have it at number one. It's a great film all the way.
Mm. I'm very glad you mentioned this, because I wasn't going to, but I still felt it must yeah. be represented. It's kind of like, we always talk about how impressive it is to film this when you're 25 and starting out as a director, but on the other hand, it's also kind of has the feeling of a movie that only a young person who hasn't really made any movies would be naive enough to think, oh, I will throw all the shit to the wall. Like, you need to be young and ballsy enough to do that.
Yeah. I agree.
Also,
I agree.
Like, trusting people like Greg Toland to be like, we're just going to do this. Like, you put someone that young who's that ambitious with someone who has experience, and then they will help each other out to make something great.
Yeah. I definitely agree. So, you're number four?
Yeah. This is one you already mentioned. It's Duel.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Yeah. So, this is, like we always said, Steven Spielberg's first movie. He already did some TV at the time, and this was a TV movie initially. When you look at it now, it looks too good to imagine, like, people watching it on a television originally, like, especially if you think about how small TVs were at the time. You're like, all the details and scope and depth that he puts in those images is just amazing. The story is very simple. It's a guy goes on a business trip. He gets in his car and he noticed he's followed by this truck. This gigantic truck is in the middle of nowhere on the highway. He's all alone. It's just him and this truck. And this truck is dead set crushing him. It's basically the dry run of what they would do later in Jaws. Like, it's kind of a movie that people would make after Jaws is successful. And people would say, yeah, we could do Jaws, but with a truck. It almost feels like that's something that would come out in 1978. Someone like they would do, what's it called, Orca. Like, those of the car, like those kind of ripoffs. I think that this car is one of the great movie monsters that is just pure evil, that's himself on four wheels. Like an entity, like it's anonymous, you never see the driver. Just driving this highway, just riding around until it finds its victim.
it's pretty good. Like we said earlier, it's a great film.
Yeah.
And like you say, you wouldn't think it's a debut film, really. It's great.
Yeah, I think it's one of the most tense movies I've ever seen. And I don't know if you've ever seen Wages of Fear.
No, still haven't seen it.
Well, you can clearly see, you know, Spielberg watched that and was like, I want to do the Wages of Fear of this generation. And, of course, later on, Friedkin would remake it with Sorcerer. So, like, a lot of these movie brats in the 70s were really inspired by that movie.
Yeah, so my number four, we already mentioned it also, but it's Hard Eight from Paul Thomas Anderson. I really love this film. The first time I saw it, it was just by chance. I was flipping channels, and I caught it right as it started. And I was glued to the TV from the beginning, which is impressive because the first act of the film is just these two guys talking to each other in a diner. And for some reason, the dialogue caught me from the beginning, and I was glued all the way from start to end to the TV, and I loved it. For those that haven't seen it, it follows a former hitman, Philip Baker Hall. It's called Sidney, which is actually the original title of the film, the title that PTA wanted. And he befriends this homeless man, who's played by John C. Reilly, and takes him under his wing and takes him to Vegas, turn him into a professional gambler. And all the things that entail about that, with the past coming back to haunt them and all the crime that they're trying to run from. But it's really good. It's a debut that is simple in its story because it's a story focused on two or three characters. But the director is so assured on what he's doing. The dialogue is so good. The plot is so captivating. And even then, he does a couple of continuous shots. I love continuous shots. And PTA does a couple of them. Have you seen the film?
Yeah, I almost picked it as my number five, but I had a hunch you would bring it up. So I was like,
okay,
I'm here, that's covered. So
there's one of the continuous shots is follows Philip Baker Hall through the casino. And it's really good because you see how he operates and how he moves in his territory, his turf. And there's another continuous shot, which is when he gets to the motel where Gwyneth Paltrow and John C. Reilly is. And it's another great shot. And you really see Paul Thomas Anderson's skills on this. But like I said, it's not even the camera work. It's the dialogue. It's the confidence in the film. It's a really good film. I love it.
Yeah, we're bringing up the dialogue. Paul Thomas Anderson has this famous quote where he says, if he doesn't know what to write, he just starts with characters sitting in a diner, which is also how Hard Eight starts. Like, Philip Baker Hall picks up John C. Reilly and starts talking to him in a diner. So I mentioned Le Silence de la Mer earlier, and Melville made this movie in 1955 that I also mentioned, Bob Le Flambeur, which is, I think, clearly an inspiration for Anderson in this movie, because it's also about an older gambler working with a younger gambler. Then there's a girl involved. Like, it's not the direct copy, but I think it was an inspiration for Anderson.
So let's go with your number three.
This also one you mentioned earlier. It's The Maltese Falcon, 1941, John Huston. We talk about Citizen Kane just redefining movies next to come in 1941. But John Huston, who worked as a screenwriter before this, kind of like set the tone for like the noir genre later on with his first movie. Like, it's the third time this Dashiell Hammett novel was adapted. I've read the novel, by the way, and I've never seen the earlier versions, but I think everyone unanimously agrees, like, this is the definitive version. It's made Humphrey Bogart the star. I mean, he was already on his way there, but I think this and then Casablanca the year after really solidified it. In the novel, Sam Spade is a very cold-hearted and cruel character, and I think he's still that way in the movie, but it just, like, Bogart is so naturally charismatic.
Yeah,
it makes it a bit more digestible, even if he isn't really trying to, but it's this movie that is just, like, full of twists and maybe even more expository dialogue than even Inception, but you accept it because most of it is performed by Sydney Greenstreet. It's like this amazing backup characters. Like, you have Sydney Greenstreet, you have Peter Lorre, which this is one of Peter Lorre's best performances, and then you have, what's this called, Elijah Cook Jr., who's in every third 1940s movie in America, I think. Like, he shows up everywhere. Like, there he is, just, like, having one scene. It's like noir genre would get a lot more cynical and dirtier in years to come. But this is like a lot more pulpy, a lot more fun. And it has maybe the greatest MacGuffin in any movie ever. Like, the Maltese Falcon is just like, it speaks to the imagination so much.
What's the last line that they say?
Stuff that dreams are made of?
Yes, that's the line, yeah. We don't even know what the stuff that dreams are made of, but that there it is.
Yeah.
It's a great film. You want to know what my number three is?
Yeah.
The Maltese Falcon.
Great.
So we had a great overlap there. Mm. There's not much to add, really. It's great. I mean, the dialogue alone, the script and the dialogue is so snappy, so witty. Those back and forth that only Bogey can deliver. But then you have a great villain in Sydney Greenstreet that was actually his first film, talking about debut, that was actually his first film, which is impressive on its own. But the film is great, really. I rewatched it, I think, last year. I had seen it a long time ago, and I rewatched it last year, and I was blown away again. It's great, so there's not much to add there. I think I read, I don't have the exact quote, but I think I read a quote from Huston that he said that for the film to be successful, you have to give equal space to every character.
Mm.
And you kind of get that here. I mean, you have all four main characters and they all get their chances to shine. Even Elisha Cook, which is the most supporting of them.
Yeah.
What about your number two?
Okay, so my number two is Blue Collar, 1978, Paul Schrader's first movie.
I haven't seen it.
So after Huston, we're having another screenwriter. He did Rolling Thunder and, of course, Taxi Driver before this. And then he decides to make his first. Now, the three lead characters are Richard Pryor is in this, Harvey Keitel, and Yaphet Kotto.
Okay.
And apparently he told all three of them that they were the star of the movie. And then these three alpha male stars would come in and they hated each other. And they hated Schrader. Like, it was a terrible production because you have someone like Pryor who only would do one or two takes per scene. And then you had Keitel who would do like five takes just to warm up before he would do the actual thing. And the lighting apparently was also very difficult because then you have Harvey Keitel, who's white, of course. Yaphet Kotto, who's dark black. And Richard Pryor, who is black, but in lighter kind of black than Yaphet Kotto. So then if you had to had all three in one scene, you had to really be careful with how you would light them. Because, again, they all wanted to be the stars. So they all wanted to look the best from all of them. But if you watch the movie, you can't really see it. I think I need to explain a bit about the story because it's a lesser known one than the other ones we mentioned. So it's about these three guys who work at the factory, like I think they make cars, it's in Detroit. And they're kind of fed up with their union and they have all these bills they have to pay. Like they just need to cough up a big chunk of money really fast. Like Harvey Keitel works two jobs. He works at the factory in the day and then he works at the gas station at night and he still can't pay for his daughter's braces. Like his her own braces out of wire just because they can't afford to buy braces. And they were like, okay, we like the union that we pay for doesn't help us at all, so we're gonna steal from the union. And they only intend to steal like $3,000. Like they don't imagine to steal more, but when they get the loot, they realize that they not only do they have those $3,000, they also have a bunch of information that proves that the union has been committing fraud and investing money in the mafia and all those things. And at that point, they become a target. And the union quickly finds out that it's them and they start to set them up against each other. There's this famous line in the movie, like everything that is there in the world is just to keep them in their place. It's one of the greatest movies about class difference I've ever seen. And I think it's one of the greatest movies of the 1970s, to be honest. And I think it should be talked about more. And I think that's happening right now, especially after Schrader kind of came back on the scene with First Reformed. People are rediscovering his earlier works.
Yeah, I love First Reformed, but I hadn't even heard about this. But now that you mention it, it sounds really, really interesting. So I'm going to put it on my watch list.
Yeah.
So my number two is Eraserhead from David Lynch.
Perfect.
Have you seen it?
I've seen it, yeah. I went to see this when I was 16 years old at the theater, and I took my dad with me, who at that point, like my dad really loves The Elephant Man, but he hadn't seen another David Lynch movie, and my dad still hasn't forgiven me for that evening. Like he will bring it up like once in a while, like, I still can't believe you took me to that movie.
It's a great film. I mean, I had seen several Lynch films. I'm a huge fan of Mulholland Drive. And just to give a bit of background, when I saw Mulholland Drive back in 2001, 2002, when it was released, I remember that I rented that film and I put it in. I saw it. Once it finished, I rewind and started it again.
Mm-hmm.
And saw it, I think, like three times in a row, if I'm not mistaken. I was blown away by it. With Eraserhead, a good Twitter friend recommended to me. Actually, it was the Twitter friend that was supposed to be guesting. She's the one that recommended it to me. And
so she's here in spirit.
Yes, she's here in spirit. I had heard about it, but I hadn't even seen it. She told me, no, you have to see this film. And I saw it, and I was mesmerized or captivated by it so much that the other day I had to put it in stand and I had to say I have to see this again.
Yeah.
Not so much to understand, because there's not so much you can understand about what's happening.
Yeah.
But to feel, I know it sounds cliche, but Lynch films, that's something that I got from Mulholland Drive also, that you don't understand so much as you feel what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And Eraserhead has that quality. And it's so captivating, so mesmerizing, so weird. And the process to get to that is also impressive, because it took David Lynch, I think it was like 7 years to make it. He was a student and he started directing it and he didn't have the money to finish it and he had to keep postponing all the recording, to the point that Jack Nance had to keep his hair long for all those years because he didn't know when Lynch was going to call him and said we have to film or we have to record.
Mm.
But it's great. It's a film that I think any cinephile has to see.
Yeah, it's both the most Lynchian movie ever, and also he never really made another movie that's like that again.
Yeah.
I mean, I think I haven't seen Inland Empire, but people have compared it like it's kind of like he does certain things a little bit similar, like certain kind of alienation that he does in Eraserhead Returns in Inland Empire.
So let's go with your number two.
One, I think.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, your number one.
My number one is Blood Simple, 1984, Joe and Ethan Coen.
Yes.
It's probably my favorite Coen Brothers movie, but I mean, there are a lot of options for that. Joel Coen at the time was an editor. He worked on The Evil Dead for Sam Raimi. And Ethan Coen, who's a little bit younger, like I think he wanted to be a playwright. Like he started philosophy, and like for years they tried to collect the money to make this, mostly by dentists. Like people they knew in their area, like dentists paid for this movie. Like it has Emmett Walsh is in this, who is great. And Frances McDormand is here early on. They met Frances McDormand while casting this movie, and at the end of the production, she was together with Joel Coen, and they're still together now. I always imagine if I would make a movie, it would be a bad version of this. Like, I would make a kind of like Blood Simple Fargo type of movie, like, but it just wouldn't be as good as this. Because this is like, when you talk about being self-assured, like this, like there is a shot in this where it's late at the bar, and you just go over a table until a close-up of someone drinking. It's just like, if you imagine like how cheap that movie was made at the time by two beginning directors, it's really impressive. Maybe one of my favorite moments in Coen Brothers' career is the final, where it's just like this. Again, like what we were talking about earlier, they just have this like two almost empty apartments, and you have these two people, and you have this, okay, what can we do to make this as tense as possible, this set piece? And it's so inventive, and it's kind of weird that they didn't really make this kind of tense movies very often, like they would do No Country for Old Men later on, but they're not really like masters of suspense like you think of someone like Hitchcock or De Palma or Fincher, but they can do it as good as anyone.
I don't know, have you heard the story about how they came up with the money, how they marketed the film to find funding?
I know they tried to sell it like as a horror movie for like and the investors.
Yeah, they directed a dummy trailer that featured just a couple of shots and a couple of scenes. The scene where Dan Hedaya is on the floor and the other guy starts dragging the shovel through the concrete. They directed that scene, but instead of Dan Hedaya, do you know who was on the floor?
No.
Bruce Campbell.
Oh, really?
Yes.
It's kind of weird that Bruce Campbell hasn't been in the Coen Brothers movie, actually.
Yeah,
maybe he was.
I don't know why.
Like he would be really good in it.
But they directed that scene and a couple of other simple shots, and they assembled this dummy trailer, and that's what they started presenting people to try to get funding for the movie.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it just adds to that. Like you said, that self-assuredness and confidence that you need to have. You know, we have this, and that was our pitch. That's what they said. They showed that dummy trailer, and that's how they got the film made.
It also, like, just as a crime movie, how its story is told is just like one character makes a move, and then all the other characters interpreted that move, and sometimes they will receive it as something else, and it's kind of like, it's small but and concise, but it's really about all these characters and how they react as individuals in the story. It's not really a plot, it's really just the characters behave and they decide how the plot evolves.
I love it. I had Blood Simple on my short list, and I think I almost had it on top five, but eventually swapped it with another one. But it's great. I love it too.
Yeah.
So my number one, when making up the list, I thought about Leaving It Out, because maybe anybody that knows me would probably know which one would be my number one. But eventually I say, you know, I'm going to be true to myself and I'm going to say it. So my number one is The Shawshank Redemption from Frank Darabont.
I knew this was coming.
Yeah, I mean, I said, I'm going to justify saying because he directed a TV film prior, so I'm going to keep it away and keep the list more interesting, so to speak. But eventually I said, you know, if I'm going to be true to myself, I think it's a great way to finish my list, and it would be with my favorite film of all time. The film really moved me in a way that no other film has moved me. I saw it very, very young. You probably have heard this story a thousand times. But
let's just do it that way. I think people like to hear this.
Yeah. I saw it when I was a teenager, at a time that maybe I was having some issues, some random teenage issue, but the kind of issue that you feel like it's going to wreck your world.
Yeah.
And I remember seeing this film and that message of get busy living or get busy dying and keeping hope despite adversities and whatever really got to me. Ever since, the film has been my favorite film. And even now, as I rewatched it, I still find great things to admire in it. So I wouldn't say it's entirely a thing of that's nostalgia, that's because, but really when you look at it, Frank Darabont did a great job at it, to the point that one has to wonder how the heck did this guy direct this, because he hasn't done anything like since. The way he sets up things, his choice for shots, how to highlight certain structures in the prison, or how to highlight certain characters, the way he uses shadows, it's great. I really love it. I wouldn't have had any other film at number one, so that's it. Shawshank Redemption is my number one.
Yeah, like, it's one of the more interesting Stephen King adaptations out there, because a lot of Stephen King stories are played by this trope that's called the magical Negro. Like, I think The Green Mile is a good example of this. And Morgan Freeman in this movie is not that, because the character wasn't written as being black. He was supposed to be Irish.
Yes.
That's what's why he was called Red. But
yes.
I think by casting Morgan Freeman, who like also makes the movie better by just the gravitas of being Morgan Freeman. I mean, he wasn't as big of a name, I think, at that point as he was, would become later on, but Morgan Freeman, like I said, the gravitas that he has is something that very few actors have.
This was actually his first narration.
Oh, really?
Something that he has become known
for.
This was actually the first time he narrated. And I was reading some trivia about it a while ago, and he recorded the narration on one take.
Jesus.
Which is impressive.
Yeah.
It's a great film, and something that gets lost a bit in the discussions of the film is that this is not a film about Andy.
No.
Which is played by Tim Robbins. This is Morgan Freeman's film. The arc is Morgan Freeman. And sometimes that gets kind of lost in the shuffle, but we start with Red and we end with Red. And another thing that sort of gets lost is that a lot of people expect more quote-unquote realism out of the film, but the film is not meant to feel real necessarily. The film is meant to play more like a fable. You know, the way that some events are repeated, like, for example, how Brooks behaves once he goes outside and how Red behaves once he goes outside. Or the way that the parole hearings for Red play out, sort of in a similar way. It's meant to be more like a fable, not a real life story of prison crime and whatnot. And that's something that I think that a lot of people hold against it, because they're not looking at it the way that I think it's supposed to be looked at.
Yeah, people have a tendency to take things too literal sometimes.
Yes.
I think, like, in a lot of circles, it's considered the greatest movie of all time. Just like in other circles, it's Citizen Kane. I know this is your favorite movie, but it's also the number one movie on IMDb. And I think that's also partly because, similar to something like Goodfellas, it's a great movie. Like, if it plays on TV, like, you can basically come in at any time it plays, because every 5 minutes there's a great scene. It's a collection of only great scenes, and every 5 minutes you get another one. So you can basically come in every time when it plays on TV, and you will be like, oh, what's this? I'm gonna watch this. It's good.
So those are our top five.
Yeah.
A great list all around. So it was a great discussion.
Yeah, I agree.
Is there any other film that you'd like to mention? Maybe an honorary mention, or one that maybe you'd like to highlight that didn't make your list?
I had one, which is The Kid by Charlie Chaplin. I considered it, but it's kind of like tricky, because during that time, the idea of a feature was different than what we have now. So, because The Kid is only like 53 minutes or something, which at that time was already considered like pretty long, especially for a comedy. Because, you know, they didn't really think about it in minutes like they think about it in reels. And I think up to that point, Chaplin had mostly done like 2 or 4 reelers. And so this is technically his debut feature, but it's not really a feature like we think of it now. So I decided to leave it off the list. But it's an amazing movie.
Yeah, no, it's my favorite Chaplin out of the ones I've seen. I think I didn't consider it at all because of that, but it's great.
Yeah.
I know Jake will be proud to hear you mention it.
Yeah, I had it. He talks about it on the first episode of my show, and I hadn't seen it at that time, but some days after that I watched it for the first time. I was like, okay, I understand. Yeah, this is amazing.
Yeah, you got it. One that I would like to highlight is The Blair Witch Project.
mm-hmm.
directed by Daniel Myrick and Eduardo Sanchez. One of the reasons I want to highlight that one, it almost made my list, is all the circumstances mm-hmm. around the production of that film. It was made for a couple of $1,000s. I think it was $40,000 mm-hmm. or something like that. Two first-timers. And the way they crafted that film and the way they marketed it mm-hmm. and the way they released it, I think it was pure genius. I saw that film in theaters back in the day, and I think I was the only one that got it when I walked out
mm-hmm.
because I think most people were like, man, what was that shit or what was that? But I was captivated by it. I mean, when I was a teenager, I used to camp a lot. So that part of them being lost in the woods mm-hmm. spoke to me. And the way they handled the dread and the fear and what you hear, the noises and all that, I identify with that. But it's so well made and so scary. I don't know if you've seen it, but
no, I haven't actually.
Nah, man, you have to put yourself in the right frame of mind, yeah. I think. But it's so great. And when you see the way they play the documentary style at first, mm-hmm. when they start with interviews with supposed locals and the things they say and how they set up certain things, it's great. I really love it. And it's a pity that they haven't been able to make more out of it, because the two, I think they directed one or two films.
Mm-hmm.
They haven't been successful at all. But this was a great film, and it was like a product of the time,
mm-hmm.
being one of the, not the first found footage, obviously, but really, it really blew up that subgenre.
I think it's partly because of the success and the eventual hatred people had towards that subgenre that's maybe like lessened the reputation of the Blair Witch Project. But I think most people, especially people who saw it at the time of its release, all tell me like, you hadn't seen anything like it before, and you had seen a lot of things like it after, but nothing as good as that.
Yeah, but it's great. I went and asked people on Twitter to share their favorite directorial debuts. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to close with this. I'm going to read a couple of what people share with me.
Mm-hmm.
Sylvie at Sly_Wit said, I had a pretty long list, but I've whittled it down to this: Citizen Kane, The Maltese Falcon, Diner, Delicatessen, Reservoir Dogs, Shallow Grave, Watchda, John Wick, The Diary of a Teenage Girl, Lady Bird, and Revenge. And she had a long list. She said she whittled it down.
Yeah, Reservoir Dogs was one I also wanted to put on the list, but I was kind of like expecting you to talk about it.
I had it, yeah. But eventually I decided not to include it.
I'm glad it's still mentioned, though.
Yeah. Tim Dougherty at Tim Dougherty said, off the top of my head, I have to go with Nolan's Memento, Coen's Blood Simple, or Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs. Besides believing they're all great films, they also perfectly capture the auteur styles they'd eventually become famous for. Obviously, we talked that Memento is not Christopher Nolan's debut,
yeah.
And he said he would check following. And he said another one I'd have to include would be Soderbergh's Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which is another great film. I also had it on my shortlist.
Me too, yeah.
My good friend, Art by Alex, at Art by Alex J, he said, I wouldn't say best, and it's not even high cinema, but I really dug what Robert Rodriguez did with El Mariachi and A Shoestring Budget, which you mentioned mm-hmm. In your discussion. And what you said, I didn't even know that he did that. That's really good, and that's a great approach to filming.
Mm.
John Reynolds, at John Reynolds 42, he says, three of my favorites are Whiplash, Erased, Razorhead, and A Single Man.
Mm-hmm.
I clarified that Whiplash was not Damien Chazelle's debut. He directed a 2009 film called Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench.
Mm-hmm.
But the other ones are great. Razorhead obviously was on my list, and A Single Man, I hadn't heard about it. It's by Tom Ford? Tom Ford, yeah. He was a fashion designer or something.
Yeah, that's also like an interesting thing. People in other media coming to movies later on in their careers and doing their own thing with it.
Yeah, like I said, Ridley Scott was a commercial director or mm-hmm. screenwriters trying to direct.
Yeah, I haven't seen A Single Man, but I own it, so I will watch it eventually.
Ken at InterKen said, this is off the dome, but Ex Machina was stunning. You'd have no idea it was Alex Garland's first.
Mm-hmm.
I know insider info is that, though uncredited, Garland was the director on Dread 2 years previous, but that's a great movie too.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know about all the controversy regarding Dredd.
Yeah.
But apparently Carl Urban has said that the director was actually Alex Garland.
Yeah, Carl Urban has said that, but I think he also said he mostly did his work in the editing phase, not really in the directing phase. So
okay.
It's kind of like wishy-washy, I guess.
Yeah. Mark Davies at VC1690 said Mad Max, but it is my favorite all-time film. He also mentioned 12 Angry Men and Dog Soldiers.
I'm very happy 12 Angry Men is mentioned because I kind of forgot about it. But like, again, someone, the director...
Sidney Lumet,
yeah. Like, he was already like in his 30s or 40s by this time. He was, I think, very successful in theater before this.
I had like 5 or 7 films on my shortlist that I left out, and 12 Angry Men was one of it. Kerem Maliki Sanchez, my man at K Maliki Sanchez, he mentioned Pi by Aronofsky, Gattaca by Andrew Niccol, Sex, Lies, and Videotape by Soderbergh, Titus by Julie Taymor, Being John Malkovich by Spike Jonze, and American History X by Tony Kaye.
Those are great picks.
Yeah. The only one I haven't seen out of those is Titus.
I haven't either. I think the director of that also initially directed the play.
Okay.
Then they asked her to adapt the play for a movie the same way she did for a play.
That's good. Melody Owen at This TLE Press, she said Eraserhead. Groundhog Dames podcast at Groundhog Dames, they said, ooh, got us thinking. Once we've seen recently the standout, Sorry to Bother You, Fantastically Oddball, stays with you long after. I agree. It was a weird, great film. Coherence, I haven't seen it, but they called it a hidden gem mindbender. Queen and Slim, I haven't seen it either, but they called it beautifully shot. Outlaw Fairy Tale really takes you on a journey. And Jolene at JMR_18, she said Thief from Michael Mann. I remember watching it and being completely amazed that it was a debut. That's a great film also.
It's not his debut movie, I think. He did a television movie, I think, The Jericho Mile before it.
I don't know. Maybe it would be then his feature film debut. But either way, it's a great film.
Yeah, that might be it. It's amazing, yeah.
So that's it, Leonard. Have you had fun?
Yeah, I had a lot of fun.
Great. Where can people find you?
People can find me on Twitter under Monsieur Marlowe. The podcast is called The Talking Pictures Podcast, which doesn't have its own Twitter handle, but if you follow me or you follow Jake Lenberg or you follow the C4 Cinema account, which is Jake's blog, you will find it there.
That's great. Really, it's been a pleasure having you here, Leonard. I hope we can do it again sometime.
Yeah, I would love to.
Thank you very much. Have a great day, Leonard.
Yeah, thank you. You too.
Well, that was it for our first episode of 2021, the first loot of Thief's Monthly Movie Loot. I want to thank Leonard again for coming on short notice. Remember to look for him on Twitter at Monsieur Marlowe and also to check out his podcast, Talking Pictures. Also, as you probably noticed, we're debuting a new intro. So I wanted to thank Tino Mendez and Paper Yellow for the music. As for me, everybody can follow me on Twitter at ThiefCGT, ThiefCGT, and you can follow the podcast at TMML2021. Remember to follow us and share the link so more people can join us in the loot. Also, stay tuned for our next episode. We're going to alternate our regular episode talking about the films I'm seeing with these new episodes with special guests. We already have a great guest lined up for February, so keep your ears peeled. Once again, thanks to everybody for listening and keep looting. Have a great day.
What's your name?
Davis.
My name's McArdle. Well, so long.